Okay. I said to you guys last week that you were supposed to practice being courageous, and I invited you to tell me if you practiced. So, did anyone have any experiences? Did you practice anything that we talked about last week? Yes, thank you, Chidambar.
Mm-hmm. I read through the chapter again, and you said God alone.
Right.
Many
times. Yeah. And what happened to you when you did that? I'm going to try a chair and see if this works. Uh-huh. He said, he read through the papers and the phrase God alone was in there a lot of times. So you used that as a mantra this week. And what happened when you did that, Chidambar? Very good. You're skipping ahead, though. You're taking my thunder for some future classes, but that's all right. We should pass the microphone around so that these will come out on the recording too. Please just turn it on and don't bother to turn it off. Thank you. That's just because a lot of people listen on the internet. You know, that was Sister Gyanamata's motto, and it is, it's a real winner. Okay. So, next, anybody else? Did anybody else think about this last week, during the week?
I was struck. I just read this tonight, so I can't say it was during the week, but... When Swami looked into Master's eyes, Swami was having a tough time, and he said, Master, please bless me. And Master looks at him and says, oh, I have been blessing you more than you'll ever know. You needn't ask.
Yeah.
You needn't ask. I was so touched by that.
That's
and I feel that, too, from Master.
You know, there's that quotation that Swami always does from the French saint, if you knew how much God loves you, you would die for joy. And every single person who has one of these death and return experiences, what they always come back with is how much love there is and how, like, there's no judgment and there's just nothing but affection for us. I just read this death and return book called Fast Lane to Heaven. And it's really was quite entertaining. And he was drawn up into this place where there was a stadium full of astral beings, like a huge stadium. And he was in the center of it, and they were all cheering him. And he led a horrible life, basically. But it was like nobody cared. They were just cheering for him to do the right thing. And he actually said he had his life review in front of the whole stadium.
Oh my goodness.
But he said in the context, there was not the slightest bit of concern on his part because they were all radiating so much love to him. It was really quite startling. And then later, after he has to come back, when he finally begins to turn his life around and stops being so utterly self-absorbed, he has a spiritual experience and he sees that stadium in the sky. And he sees all those astral beings cheering him like this because he's actually doing something selfless in the world instead of just self-indulgent. Isn't that fascinating? It's amazing. Any other comments or thoughts from anything from this last week? All right. I will take that you are being silent but not inactive. Okay. All right. I'm going to spend a little more time. I think all of you got the email, so you all know how to get these notes of Swamiji's, and you probably are reading ahead, so I don't have the advantage I had last week of your not knowing what's in here. But there was another... A couple of more points, which are general points about courage and general points about attitude that I want to... If you don't know, write to Dambar and he'll tell you how to get the download on this. They're on the website now. But isn't it password protected, or don't you have to have some? Okay. Okay. In relation to this class, then. All right. Swami says in here, never give up. Always be ready for God. This is about courage. Sorrow has no being of its own. It is in the subjective nature of the fighter. That's how he puts it. This is not like the beautiful finished writing that Swami does. These are just notes. Sorrow exists because we constantly affirm it, because of a habit of attitude toward events. You know, and it's just, I know that I talked about this a little bit last week, but I just wanted to, we have such a deeply held belief that certain situations have to make us unhappy. Swamiji made a very interesting comment when I was visiting there about 10 days ago. I don't think I said this in class, but we had been talking about chauvinism among women. Did I say this to you guys yet? Okay. Just in an earlier conversation, he was remarked, we just started talking about how prejudicial people can be, and Swami's fond of mentioning some very chauvinistic woman, very, you know, women's liberation, as it used to be called, who claimed that, in fact, men were no taller than women. You know, it was just like the capacity of emotion to divine reality. Men are really not taller than women. It just appears to be that way. I mean, who knows? So we were just laughing about that. So then later on, Swamiji brought up, and these were the actual words he used. He said, to claim that one half of a duality is better than the other half, he actually used the word grotesque. He said it's grotesque. And I thought he was still referring to the woman, and so I sort of said something joking about the men and women. He was totally serious. He said, no, I mean any duality. Because any duality is movement off of the center. So if you're in a state of perfect peace and you go into a state of elation and then that leads to a state of depression, all you have really done is vibrated off of center. And inherent in any one, you know, movement of energy away from perfect stillness is the necessary balancing in the opposite direction. So all dualities, as he often says, are two sides of the same coin. And if you take a quarter and say that the heads is worth 25 cents, but the tail is only worth 5 cents, it's just absurd. You know, and you always have to spend it with this side up because this is where the money is rather than on the other side. You can just see how crazy it is because there are two sides of the same coin. It's a cliche phrase. So Swami was trying to help us to understand that everything that happens is a mirror image because it's all a vibration of energy away from the still point at center. And the ego has a strong preference for one or the other because we have habituated ourselves to thinking that this is pleasurable. And we have habituated ourselves to thinking that this is painful. But as our consciousness advances, we often begin to see in a very different light what people would think of as very pleasurable. We don't think of as pleasurable anymore because it doesn't please us. It's almost like it reverses. You know, drunkenness. And I was in a restaurant and people started drinking wine. And, you know, they're just ordinary people drinking wine. But, you know, this, I'm not at all used to people drinking. And this energy begins to set in. And they think they're having fun, but the more they think they're having fun drinking, the more it looks like exactly the opposite to me, which is partly just saying, you see, it's very subjective. And even there, sometimes saints say, there was a song that Master used to like that says, come to me as sorrow, because when I am in sorrow, I can't forget you. And a lot of times people find that when things are very difficult, they actually have a stronger sense of God remembrance than what gets easy. So which is the positive and which is the negative? But whether or not we can expand our consciousness that far or not, even the very thought that it has to be, it's always equal by its very nature, tells us that it's just a habit of the mind to think otherwise. And it's a habit of the mind because we don't want to put out the energy, we don't want to fight against our inclinations, we just want to take a soft birth, we have more tamasic energy than rajasic energy, lots of reasons, but none of those are really inherent, they're just a habit. It's the subconscious telling us that the less energy I put out, the better off I'll be. You know, that subconscious is more dynamic than superconscious. So even all those ideas are just a matter of attitude toward it. Circumstances can be exactly what they are. And I was talking to someone and they were grieving the loss, actually, of the death of someone close to them in their family. They were grieving the loss of an elder relative whom the person had loved and had been a wonderful contributing person in their life, but now the person was gone. And the grief process for this soul just, you know, kept going on and on. And finally, sometimes I lose patience. Oh, what a shock to all of you who know me well. Sometimes I lose patience. And I just said, you know, like, enough already. It's like, this person lived a very good life. You were very fortunate to have them, but at some point or another, He was tired, he was sick, he wanted to go. It's just not fair for you to sort of feel somehow. But it was astonishing to me. The response was, well, that's an unusual attitude. I said, for heaven's sakes, as a devotee, what other attitude could you have? You know, what do you think death is? Did you actually imagine that we, you know, get to keep our parents forever? Like my parents, you know, are not going to ever die. They'll be 970 years old and we'll all just still be here together. It's like Methuselah or something. Of course they die. And we have to very, very strongly and with great deal of discrimination question everything that comes to us that causes us to go off center and really ask ourselves, is this actually wisdom or is this merely habit? Now, bearing in mind that this whole course is about moving into an ashram, and Swamiji even wrote it, moving into a monastery, in which we have totally repudiated. Now, what's so tricky about this spiritual path is that we do that, but you can't tell that we've done that. You know, I do now. Well, I'm dressed in a more or less normal manner, but now some of us are always dressed in blue, and my whole closet has gone away. So I used to be able to say we look like everyone else. I don't quite all the time look like everyone else, although it doesn't really show. But we basically look like everyone else. We live more or less like everyone else. So we have to tell ourselves, no, no, no. I mean, I sometimes think about this because, you know, I've seen movies and I can sort of remember these, like especially whenever you see a dramatization of the life of Frances and Claire, and Claire runs away from her family and she goes to the monastery and Frances cuts off her beautiful blonde hair, and the more horrible the movie, the more dramatically they do it. You know, this beautiful woman, they cut off her hair, and then she's there with the shorn head, and then he spirits her off to this monastery where he's going to hide her, and they knock on the door. This big door opens like this, you know, and then there's some wizard old nun underneath, and she grabs the young girl and takes her in, and the door goes clank like this behind, you know, and so like there's no mistaking that something has happened. You know something has happened. And in fact, as the story goes on, the real story goes on, her brothers came to get her back. You know, women didn't have the freedom to do things like this, and they were counting on her to make a perfect political alliance and, you know, marriage of convenience for the family, and they were outraged. So they came to get her. And one of the ways, when her brothers were there trying to take her out, was she pulled off her veil and she'd cut her hair. And the fact that she'd cut her hair, it frightened them, because she had really given herself to God and repudiated the world by having cut her hair. And then they got a little scared. And then actually her sister came, Agatha came. And I think this is correct. I can't remember if it was Claire or Agnes. But one of them clung to the rail, and the men couldn't lift her off. You know, she just held on, and her big, strong brothers couldn't get her off. Scared them. They left her there. Now, in our life, as disciples of Master in 2010, in America, we don't get to do that or have to do that, just depending on which way you look at it, you know, whether you think it's a blessing or a curse, not to be able to go into some big stone building and have this big clanking thing come through and this big grate be literally between us and the world. But don't kid yourself. You know, if you really are planning to be a disciple, if you really are wanting to live for God, that's what you've done. Or sooner or later, that's what you must do. It's not going to show externally, because this is not the age of form. This is the age of energy. But what that means is we have to realize this is not business as usual. We can't just sort of go along with everybody else's attitude. Oh yeah, this is how I feel. And especially all the ways in which people in the world tell us that you must suffer. You have to be upset about this. You have to worry about that. You must grieve for this. Forget it. It's just an attitude of the mind. And that's when Swami even talks about, again, as I was saying, he just talks about sorrow. It's just a habit of the mind. It's like, yes, the word challenge is a real word. The word dynamic energy is a real word. You know, the word I have to find a solution, those are real words. But sorrow is optional. I discovered really dynamically in the summer of 1976, when Ananda Village, a great deal of it burned down in early June, this in the afternoon, I think it was June 11th or something like that, 1976, which was now really a long time ago. In certain points in one's own life, just stay there and kind of in the eternal now. But I realize I sound like an old woman when I talk dynamically about something in 1976 when many of you weren't even born. That's when it gets really embarrassing. You're born in a different decade and I'm talking about these events. I look at my house too and I see I have just stuff in my house that, I, you know, like things like a spatula or a frying pan, you know, things that have been there for a long time. And I remember my grandmother and my mother, they just had so much old stuff. And sometimes you just would want them to throw away all that old stuff. But there I am thinking, it's perfectly good. And you also get into this strange thought, which is, you know, I'm going to die soon anyway, I don't need a new one. So I see these age-related issues, which I try to avoid. But anyway, it was 1976, what can I say? And this fire came through, and it came through in the afternoon. It started in, you know, just for those of you who know Ananda Village, we were up on Rajasi Ridge, and we were looking down a couple of canyons, and it was like 7 years into a drought year, and there was this big fire. We could see a few canyons away, I mean, which was some distance, but the wind was behind us, behind the fire. Fire is burning uphill with the wind behind it. And I remember I was standing there with Jyotish, and I said, you know, this one looks like it really could burn us, because we'd lived out in the forest for years, and there were lots of forest fires, and it never is going to happen to you. But we were just looking at this. We see nothing but really, really dry trees in a complete wilderness area after years of drought on a very hot summer afternoon, burning uphill with the wind behind us. So the question comes in your mind, like, what is going to stop this? It was really quite a moment. And we sort of said, you know, we all got up there. We had fire preparedness. We were all trained to help fight forest fires. And somebody had gotten, like, ordered from somewhere, who knows where, these, because you're supposed to wear long sleeve things. So even though it would be really hot, we'd all keep long pants and boots and gloves and scarves and hats somewhere in case there was a fire, because they came up all the time, often enough. So somebody had ordered all these little blue jackets with little Mandarin collars, so they looked like Oriental things. And so everybody's out there fighting the fire in these blue smocks, which made us look like Vietnamese. You know, it was the Vietnam War at that period of time, and all this smoke, and we're all running around in these, all in these uniform, little uniforms that look like little communist uniforms. You look around, you see us all in the smoke and confusion, running around looking like all we needed was little hats like this. It was really a very bizarre moment. And we're up there on the top of the hill, and we have our little tools, and we're doing just what we're trained to do. We were all young then. We could all do this, scraping a fire line like this. And this fire comes up over that hill, and it just sort of looked at our fire. You know, fire has a real consciousness. It looked at our fire line, and it went, and it just jumped over our heads and started burning on the other side. So all of a sudden, we're standing, you know, on the road and our scratched fire line, but the fire is on both sides of us. And then we watched it over there, you know, some distance, and it went to a tall stand of trees. It hit the bottom tree. It shot up to the top. I mean, all this happens like that. Fire is really fast. Hit the bottom, went to the top, and began what they call tree topping. It just started tree topping just before our eyes, just racing like that. And all of the houses in that part of the Ananda were all in those trees, in those very thick trees. We're standing there watching it go like that with fire on both sides of us. We all looked at each other and said, this is not really smart. I think we should get out of here. So we all rushed, you know, out of there. I mean, none of our residents were hurt. Somebody, one of those planes that drops fire retardant, his plane crashed, actually, and that man died. But no one else was hurt on the whole thing. But all of this happened within 45 minutes or an hour of when Jyotish and I were standing there and saying, this might happen. So we all ran down to the lowest point, tremendous confusion, and people started running. It was in the middle of the day, so most people were not in their homes, and people just got in trucks and started running to where the houses were. So it was this marvelous experience where you were going into someone else's house trying to figure out what they might want you to keep, want you to save, because we were totally, nobody ever imagined this would happen. Now people have lists and boxes, but you just go into someone else's house and think, gee, I wonder what they might want. And someone said to Jyotish, Jyotish was the author of the best lines of the whole experience, they said, as he rushed into his house, because he went into his own house, their only child had been born 11 days prior to this. Devi was in town with the baby at the well baby clinic when this whole fire struck. So they say to Jyotish, you know, take what's ever valuable. And which is a really bad thing to say to such a philosophical man. What, he says, is of value. and to a certain extent, and I really respect him for this, it was like, I'm not going to grovel in front of this fire. If it wants what I have, I'm just going to give it to him. And they had been like cleaning their altar or something, so most of their altar items were in a box. So he more or less picked up that box, a couple of things, just wandered out. Somebody else came later, got diapers, some of the baby's clothes, you know, stuff like that. But in a matter of about an hour, 21 houses at Ananda went to ash. I mean, you know, they weren't just singed, they were ash. Just totally. I mean, these were owner-built little houses, ash, just like that. And, you know, other parts of it were saved. The public areas never burned. I was in charge of publications at that time, and when we saw what was going to happen, we drove trucks up to what is now Hansa Temple Publications Building, and we had a printing press in there, and, you know, books were not on computer. We had, like, original negatives for the books. So, you know, we very systematically went through there, and we took all the original negatives. We took as many of the original recordings as we could take, you know, everything that couldn't be replaced, and we took the mailing list, which was on metal plates, you know, and just threw all that into a truck and drove it downhill. And I went up to the press. It weighs about 5,000 pounds. I kind of tried to see if I could move it like this. I mean, I was just, you're not really in your rational mind at that point. Just tried to see if I could push the press, and I was the author of this line. Someone picked up the copier or started to move the copier. I said, leave it, it's rented. And we just filled these cars and drove them down. The fire came right to the edge. And by then the firemen were there. They sent a back fire. And so it didn't actually burn that building. I mean, I'm telling you all that story just because it's a fun story. It was a great day. You know. And then we were down in the lowest part of Ananda and everything else was smoke. We didn't know how much was gone. Because when the firemen got there, they just said, children, get out of the way. And they sent us down. What were you going to say? Yeah.
Yeah. Where was Swamiji and what was his reaction?
In Hawaii, editing the path. He was out of the state. Okay, having said all of that, what was the whole point of that story? And so we were there, and we were all there. Everyone was safe. A few kittens got burned, but no people were hurt at all. And everyone was, it was actually just remarkable. We're all just down there. We really have no idea what's happened to our community. We didn't know for a number of hours because the firemen isolated us and wouldn't let us go anywhere. It was all smoke. You couldn't see past the market. But we're just all together, and people are being very cheerful. Devi comes home with the baby, and Lakshmi and she had been in town. They come to a roadblock. The policeman says, you can't go in there. She says, I'm sorry, that's my home, and she just drives around. So she comes to Jyotish with little, you know, Kalidas in her arms like this. She looks at him. They had a geodesic dome, and their dome was famous because no matter what they did, the rain poured into that. They just continually fixed the roof, and it was always filled with water. Jyotish goes to his wife. In this circumstance, he says, honey, you know that problem we were having with leaks? We don't have it anymore. I mean, that's how he told her that their whole house had gone to ash. You know, amazing. Here she's a new mother, barely a week with her baby. But that's attitude. I mean, imagine all the other ways you could have responded to that. That's right attitude from start to finish. And then we were just there. And my place didn't burn because I lived over at Ayodhya. I had nothing to lose anyway. I had this little trailer that was so small I could touch both sides of it with my hands like this. I couldn't quite touch this way, but almost. I had to energize like this, you know. For years in my life, I never energized like that because I always had to energize like this. Because if I went too up, I'd smash my hand. You could stand right under the little vent and you could kind of energize like that. And we were just there. There it was. When we were also, when Seva and I were running up the hill to the publications building, we're literally running up the hill, talking. This was when we were going up to get everything. And it was like we're talking about, and that was when I said we have to take the mailing list, get the mailing list first, because the first thing we're going to have to do is build this community again. I mean, it was burning down in that moment, and we were already getting ready to build it up again. It was by any measure, You know, anybody would think it was terrible. Even to this day, there's a certain number of families that have no pictures of their children, you know, up to a certain age because it was all burned. And, you know, people, this got talked about in Los Angeles recently, and Durga was talking about the fire, and Vidura stood up. He said, I know, it's all well and good to talk about our detachment, but there were 30 quarts of apricot jam in the basement of that house, he said. And I still think about that jam. That's the way it is. But what I was going to say, and this was the part of it, that was, we had to work so hard that summer because, you know, everything that we'd been working for, well, almost 10 years, so much of it was just gone. And people were living here and there, and all this free stuff came in, and Durga became what we called her Our Lady of the Free Box. She spent weeks just sorting through all this donated stuff and giving it to this person and giving it to that person. And, you know, and we were just doing everything we could just to pull it back together. And like by August, September, we were tired. We weren't so much discouraged or sad, but we were just sort of all looking at each other like we were tired because we had kept it together extremely dynamically, but it took a lot of energy to do that. And you know, we had to make up everything that had been taken away from us. But it never, not even once, did we even think of not doing it. I take a little pride in the fact that Swamiji always puts up this picture of me and sort of calls it the right spirit. Like 3 or 4 days later, I'm dressed in this, my bumblebee t-shirt. It was actually, it's a joke, it was actually a mini dress that had belonged to someone else with these big, big blue and white stripes. So I look like a bumblebee. And we're just out there, you know, there was nobody but us. We were just out there in the midst of all this black and ash and just picking up the brush and throwing it onto trucks. And there's some big picture of me just in my bumblebee dress with this thing in my hand. And we were having so much fun. I mean, it was so exciting. You know, how often in your life do you just lose everything? It was just such an adventure. And that's, it's just attitude. And a lot of our neighbors, you know, what came out of that was that the whole fire had been started by a county vehicle with a faulty spark arrestor that threw a spark off the road into the dry brush and it caught fire. I mean, that was just a fact. Our neighbors, because we weren't the only land that was burned, but we were much the worst, they called us up and said, you know, we can get so much money, we can get everything back. And our neighbors, and they really wanted us to join the lawsuit because we had lost so much more than anyone else collectively. And they did sue and they all got lots of money. But Swami Kriyananda said, it's the wrong consciousness. He said, it's not really free money. It's our own money, and it's the money of our neighbors. It's our taxes. It comes from somewhere. And he said, it's not, nobody owes us. This is our karma. This is our karma. This is our bad luck, is the word he used when he wrote a letter to the county. He said, I know you all are wondering what we're doing, what we're going to do. He said, we're not going to sue. He said, you know, we're just not going to take our bad luck out on our neighbors, is how he put it. Many people in town to this day think that they paid us off more under the table. That was the only way they could imagine that we would turn our back on that. But it was very interesting because many of our neighbors, even those who collected a lot of money, never recovered from that fire. They remained sad about it, even years later. You know, they just couldn't find a way to put their lives back together. And for us, it was like, well, you hear me. I mean, you know, it was an adventure. I didn't lose everything. It was harder for those who did. But still, that's courage. That's attitude. Situations are always neutral. And sorrow is a habit of the mind. Master says, how does he describe it? Tears are the sign of the liquid sign of cowardice. He's really terrible that way, isn't he? Once Swamiji really scolded me for something that I really had done. You know, it was one of those really bad moments where I really was wrong, and he decided it was the moment to really tell me. And I'm like, you know, I'm having to take it because it was the truth, but I wasn't happy about it. And he just looked at me, it just looked like this. He said, and don't cry like that. He took away my only, you know, like, positive response. I spent about a week. There's a cartoon that I saw once with Tom and Jerry, you know, the cat and the mouse. And the whole theme of it was that, let's see, the mouse, Tom is the cat, Tomcat, right? And the mouse is Jerry. And Jerry was always being chased by the cat, but he was trying to outlast the cat, and the cat had to stay awake. So the whole comedy was all these different ways that the cat had to stay awake, and he put matchsticks in his eyes like this. And one of them is he took his eyelashes. This is, I still vividly, he took his eyelashes and he put them like this, and he scotch taped his eyelids to his eyelashes to his forehead. This is a cartoon picture. Well, I spent the whole week, I felt like, with my eyelashes scotch taped to my head, just so that I would keep my eyes open and not cry like that. But it was really, really interesting to me because I have rarely cried since then. And I could feel really deep within myself that the desire to cry was the desire to just collapse under the weight of this, of being scolded. Well, I didn't mind being scolded because he was right, but collapse under the weight of, oh, I'm so sincere, I try so hard, I'm so helpless, what can I do? No one understands, you know. Fill in the blanks. You all know it. I mean, we all have to live through these things. But just that admonition to me, don't give in. And the whole thing just became about not giving in. But there was some, like, really deep karmic victory there. I don't want to claim it, because I don't want to get too, you know, these are dangerous things to claim. Let's just say that I felt different. And I'm so grateful to him. And in many ways, actually the truth of that whole experience was more odd than that. And now that I really remember it clearly. In fact, even though what he was reprimanding for before was a true characteristic of my nature, the situation itself was totally incomprehensible to me. I really, even to this day, I don't know how the whole thing ever even got going. It just was like a hallucination on some people's part, and I got involved in their hallucination, and then Swami decided to scold me for God knows what, for having the karmic tendency, so that was fair. But it really was just about don't cry. Now, see, this is like, so isn't this so counter to what the whole world tells you to do? Oh, just go and have a good cry. And God knows, don't worry, if that's what you do, do it. But don't just always think that you have to be that way. You know, we've really walked into a big stone monastery and the big gate has clanked behind us. We've done that when we've declared, I have a desire to be eternally free. I don't really just want to go business as usual for God knows how many more incarnations. I really want to be eternally free. And if I want to be eternally free, I really need to turn this around. Yes, Lord. Uh-huh. Who has the microphone?
So I have a question.
Uh-huh.
Why is it then that when you do have
a
good cry, or you know, you're able to release all of that, you feel a great state of relief, or at least I do?
That's a very good question. The question is, if crying isn't good for you, why do you feel so good after you do it? That is one of those very, very delicate balances. And actually, later on in these lessons, when we get to the question of brahmacharya, which is sexual control of sexual energy, there's this balance point where tension builds up within you, and the release of tension is a great sense of relief. The tension is gone. But the question is whether or not building up tension and releasing it, will ever do anything about what causes the tension to build in the first place. And so that's why it's a little bit of a delicate issue in this sense, is that a person has to learn to work sensitively with your own nature. And in fact, this last Sunday, in Swami's satsang, I can't remember exactly what the question was. I think it might have been about celibacy. Was it a question about sexual energy? But there was some question about discipline. And he was talking specifically about the need to be disciplined. And it was about anger, I think, about how just being angry all the time, you feel better, but it doesn't really take you anywhere. But then he sort of said, now this is a little complicated, but sometimes if you give in a little, it makes it easier to go on. So what he was really saying is that you can't dogmatize this. You just have to think about it sensitively, and sort of what you have to be is you have to be very grounded in your own reality. And you have to be able to become honestly conscious of yourself enough to know when to apply pressure and when to release it. Because if you just repress yourself all the time, you're not going to be okay either. But if you constantly think, oh, I must express myself, I mean, I have to just let it all out, you won't necessarily progress either. So you have to be right in the middle of that. And even just the thought, I've shared this with you on several occasions, this was prior to that experience with Swamiji, I had been upset about something. I used to cry a lot more. I mean, that was just who I was. But I remember once I was crying, I was upset about something, and I lay down to have a good cry. And I was lying down on my back, and I was just about ready to just go for it in a big way. And I realized, I mean, you guys, men don't know this as much as women because you don't do this as much. It's really tiring to cry. Your eyes hurt afterwards, and you just kind of feel kind of used up. You may also feel better, but it's really very tiring. So I had a lot to do that day. I'm lying on my back. I'm just about to, like, let it all out. And I think, oh, it's going to make, you know, I thought, after you're done, you're going to have to get up, and you're still going to have all that work to do, and then you're just going to be exhausted, and it's going to make it so much harder. Just like all of that just went through my head. And I said, why don't you skip the middle part? And I just got up and just went back to what I had to do. But it was like, you know, the impulse is there, but we don't always have to give in to it. And a great deal of it is having the intelligent understanding of how the system really works. And the way the system really works is if you learn self-control, but you can't just merely control the energy, you also have to raise it. And see, this is where the courage comes in, because courage by its very nature is raising the energy. You know, when we ran up the hill at publications and, you know, tried to move the press and carried all that stuff out, I mean, we weren't thinking about anything except this needs to be done, it needs to be done now. We were strong young women, but still, you know, we just moved. That's what somebody does on the battlefield. That's the classic picture of courage. You don't think about anything. You just move. And that act in itself, you see, raises the energy. And once the energy is raised, everything looks different. Raised, I mean, in the sense of up the spine, and raises your perception. What is crying? Crying is almost just the opposite, isn't it? Just collapsing. And I'm not talking about sensitive tears. I'm talking about tears of self-pity, which is what they always are. Virtually. Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
I have just another question.
Sure, go ahead.
Backtracking a little bit, what you mentioned about being centered, and when you're either depressed, you know, it throws you off balance in terms of the vibration,
right?
Or when you're joyful, it also, I mean, can you clear that up a little bit?
Yeah,
because I always figure that if you're centered, you're in a state of joy. So I'm a little bit confused on that.
I didn't use the word joy, and I was very careful not to. I used the word elated.
Elation.
Okay, this is the most sensitive one to understand, and actually we're not going to get to it tonight because it's the third attitude, but even-minded and cheerful. We're not talking about not enjoying things. We're talking about allowing our happiness to be defined because things have gone the way we want them to go. And that's what's off-centering, to not appreciate, oh, isn't this wonderful? You know, this wonderful person is now my husband. This beautiful child is now my child. This marvelously creative job is now my everyday work. To not recognize goodness when you see it and to be appreciative of the fact that it's come into your life is both unnatural and rude, you know. But to say, oh, I'm happy and I'll be happy forever because now I have this wonderful husband and look at this beautiful baby and all my sorrows are over and no more troubles are going to come to me, is just setting yourself up to have to go to the other side. So what Swamiji also expresses, and it's the truth, is all that jumping from one side to the other and defining reality, trying to define an everlasting reality in terms of a temporary condition, actually diminishes our capacity to experience the finer feelings of life. Because as soon as we commit our everlasting happiness to a temporary situation, at least subconsciously, tension begins. Because we know what's going to happen. I have a nephew, my sister's son, and he used to be little, because they always are. And now he's big, because he has big bones, he's a big man. And you know, he's just really big, and she's a small woman. And, you know, he was really cute when he was little, and he's handsome and fine as a grown man, but he's not really cute. He's not so adorable as he was when he was small. And we were in this restaurant together, and there were a lot of families in the restaurant, and we were sitting with him, and he was being less than stellar in terms of communicating and relating to us, and he was being not a little boy anymore. And there were all these darling little children around us. And I said, Beth, we should go warn them. We should take your son and say, look, look, what's going to happen? But of course, what good would it have done? But you know, as soon as you commit yourself to your happiness, because look how darling, I have this darling son who crawls on my lap and says, Mommy, Mommy, I love you. I'm going to live with you forever. And your little heart goes pity-pat, and you just think everything is perfect, and then he grows up. And he treats you differently. And that doesn't mean you can't say, isn't this wonderful? He's so sweet. It's just what a joy. But insofar as you've moved off of your center and are trying to make everlasting happiness out of something that's temporary, you know, everything about you, some part of you begins to tense at that point because you know it's not going to last. But if you stand, and the picture that I often make of this is, if you think of a tree that in our community, is that an elm tree that's right outside your apartment, the great big one? Mm-hmm. I call it the guru tree of our property. It's a beautiful tree, solid like this, with huge, the branches spread so far, you walk way far away, and then you realize you're still looking at the same tree. So it's very, very expansive. But it starts right here. And so the way to think about your life is, this is where you come from, which is the root, which is the spine, which is your centeredness and your connection. But from that root, you can go way, way out and reach really far and have fabulous experiences in all directions. But if you disconnect yourself from here and walk out on those branches, all of a sudden everything is really vulnerable. And if that branch breaks off, you're dead. You're sunk. Your happiness is over. But if you stand in the trunk and reach out, you see, you can still have it. And that's the difference. The duality is that I'll run to the end of that branch, I'll run to the end of this branch, I'll run to that branch, and then I'll make my whole world here. And it won't work. I mean, the only problem with it is really, really simple. It doesn't work. You know, nobody hates us. It just doesn't work. It's the way it is. Okay? But, well, I've been talking about courage. I'm going to finally move on. And there's just one more point he said here. Any other questions? Those are good questions, so don't hesitate. Anyone else? Comments or questions? One more point that I want to pull out of here before I go on to positive thinking. Swami says, the only time to worry is if your attitude is wrong. That's an amazing statement, isn't it? Because we would think that there would be a lot of other things to worry about. Worry about our health, worry about our relationships, worry about our money, worry about whether we're doing a good enough job. But he says the only thing you actually have to worry about is if your attitude is wrong. Because if your attitude is wrong, this is what I talked about last week when I was just talking about this in general. You know, we just can't help the karmic conditions that we've set in motion in the sense that we can't reverse them just by wanting things to be different. Whatever karmic conditions we've set in motion have already been set in motion. And we may wish now that we hadn't set them in motion, and we may realize that we were really dumb to have set them in motion. But nonetheless, we have. We're in the left lane, in the car that we've chosen, and we're going 100 miles an hour. And we may not really want to be there, but there we are. Okay. But if we have the right attitude about what comes to us, then we're not creating more of the same. And it's our attitude above all that determines, you know, whether or not present conditions will continue. Because the attitude that we have is the response of our consciousness to the karma that we have. And the whole reason you have this karma, or whatever it might be, is because we set something in motion because we need to learn the lesson of what that karma is about. Okay? And the lesson of all karma is exactly the same, which is that I stand forever in the blissful presence of God, and nothing and no one can take me out of that awareness. That's what all karma is about. So, but if we make a mistake and we treat others in a bad way, thinking of it like this, like let's say we had a sister or a brother that we didn't like all that much, and the parents left us a lot of money, but the brother doesn't have a copy of the will, and I have the only copy of the will, and what do you know? It just fell into the fire. You know, so the fact that most of the money went to the brother, well, gee, I don't know. I guess we'll just have to split it now, won't we? Because there's no will, so we just split it. Or think of 100 other examples. Well, yes, I know my sister was in love with him, but well, so am I in love with him. And if he likes me better, that's not my problem, is it? And what am I supposed to do about that? And if she dies of a broken heart, well, that's not my fault. What was I supposed to do? Not just like take him if he wanted me? You know, all these ways we justify it because we don't recognize that when we cause injury to someone else, it's our own self that we're injuring. So we set all these things in motion. We set all these things in motion, and sometimes because of the conflicting cross currents of ego, and the conflicting cross currents of ego are the energy that we have in motion. I'll give you the example that I always use because it's the clearest one I can think of. If you're 12 years old, and you're kind of a bully, and there's a little three-year-old on his tricycle, and you're riding your two-wheeler, and he's kind of coming out on the sidewalk, and you kind of like to just push little kids around, and you kind of smash into him with your tricycle, he can be absolutely enraged at you. But he's 3 years old on a tricycle, and you're 12 on your big two-wheeler, and you can just, you know, say something rude to him and just keep right on going. Because you have momentum, you have energy, and you exert, you set the karmic cause in motion, but you have enough power also that it can't catch up with you right away. That's what Master calls the thwarting cross currents of ego, which is your own personal momentum creates a cross current and the karma can't reach you. But that child grows up and he never forgets. And maybe later, as I often say, he's the banker and you need the loan. And everything about your papers is great, but not on your life are you going to get the loan from this man. You want to join the country club and he's on the membership committee and he has the power to blackball you. And it's like, why are you so after me? Maybe it's not even this incarnation, but you just come to the country club and he says, I don't know, there's something about him I don't like, because you got away with it, but you set the energy in motion. And so sooner or later, it's attached to you because we are ego-identified. We are defined by our actions. So even dying and being reborn, it doesn't cut the tie. It's not necessarily even that this person will follow you. It depends how obsessed he is with you. But the energy will follow you. And sooner or later, it hits you in the back of the head. And it hits you in the back of the head so that you say, oh my gosh, it's really awful when people just treat each other so badly. I mean, that's the reason. Or it's like, well, how does it feel when the world is against you? How much power do you have now? I mean, there's a whole lot of different lessons that can come from it. But you know, in the course of setting all these karmic things in motion, it's like throwing boomerangs. And if you throw a boomerang with a lot of energy, it may take a while before it circles back. And so we're all just sort of living our lives, and we don't really remember all the boomerangs that we threw out. What's the phrase? What goes around comes around, whatever that actually means, but it means it comes around and hits you in the back of the head. And if when it hits you, you just start the whole thing in motion. How dare you treat me like that? How awful this is that happened. Life is so unfair. I'm going to get you. You know, just everything that you can make up that is just going to keep the whole thing going. You're sending out a whole other set of boomerangs. But if instead, when those boomerangs start hitting you in the head, and oh, what do you know? I got fired and it was really unfair. Well, look at that. My wife just left me. My, I really want to, you know, be a painter, and I just broke my hand, and now I'm not going to be able to paint anymore. I mean, all these things that happen to people, I mean, those are small things. Big things happen to people. If when they come to us, there's just this calm sense, well, this is the karma. This is an appropriate response. I mean, there's lots of ways you can think about it. And one keeps up one's positive attitude. But above all, one simply just says, okay, this is what I have to deal with it now, and I'll just deal with it properly. When Swami told me not to cry, what he was telling me is watch your attitude. You know, if you've made a bad mistake, which he was telling me that I had, you made a bad mistake, a real character flaw has been revealed, the whole world knows it, which is always great fun, you know, to know that you were the only one who didn't know and that they were all aware of this and then it's you. All of those things are just the facts. You can't change one of them, but watch your attitude. Just don't allow yourself to fall into a state of, oh, poor me, poor me. Just watch your attitude. And if you watch your attitude, then you just can kind of just move through it because it's the boomerang you sent out. Where do you think it was going to land? Of course it was going to land on you. But if you can keep your equanimity when it comes, by watching your attitude, then you've neutralized it. That's how you get over the karma, is you just watch your attitude. So that's why he says, don't worry about anything as long as your attitude is right. And what is your attitude? Well, I've only talked much about courage. Courage, positive thinking at all times, even-minded and cheerful, serving God and others, and God alone, right? Living for God alone. Service to the divine and others. Okay, I'm going to, yes, why don't you ask a question, then I'll take a break.
So you've spoken before about when a karmic bomb
goes off, happens, yes, karmic
that
bomb.
That you have to raise your energy high enough to meet it.
Right.
So when you're talking about watching your attitude,
right,
sometimes the only thing you can really do is just watch it. Mm-hmm. And but you have to have the energy to be able to watch it.
Right.
So it's, you know, I've experienced before, well, this is happening, and I can see it happening, and the only thing I can do is just try not to make things worse.
Yes, that's exactly right. Okay, now here's where it comes in. This is Lourdes' question also. You know, sometimes you just have to cry. This goes to many other aspects that we've talked about. Every situation in the universe is always dual, which means that there's always a positive and a negative pole to everything. So our own consciousness always has a positive and a negative pole. There's always a spectrum of possibilities. And it doesn't matter what the theoretical spectrum is. Oh, theoretically, you know, I just got fired from the job that I love and I've been blackballed and I'll never get another job in that industry again. Oh, it's all just God and he has a great plan for me. You know, I mean, that's a theoretical possibility. But the real possibility is whether you're going to drink 17 beers or just 3. You know? And that is the real spectrum of possibilities. So victory in that moment is 3. Because that's all you actually have to choose from. And so that's where you have to learn to be sensitive with yourself, and this is not dogmatic. This is in the range of who I really am. Let me look at what's possible and let me choose the highest that I'm capable of choosing. And oddly enough, no matter how low that spectrum may look to you, if you just keep trying to land at the top end of your genuine options, you'll be astonished how quickly everything really turns around. Because for you, that's good attitude. It's not like somebody else's good attitude. It's not Jesus Christ's good attitude. It's not St. Paul's good attitude. But for me, this is good attitude. And, you know, Swami says, don't cry. I didn't cry. You know, I was just so proud. I didn't cry. I still had the same, you know, character fault, and just it was a big mess. But I didn't cry. That was my victory. And it's part of right attitude is just having the humility to recognize, puny as this is, Lord, this is my best, and this is all I've got to offer you. Swami talks in here, I think it's in this section, about the drunken devotee who, you know, was just drunk and trying to get a post hole in the hole. And it's a whole story about Narada looking for the best devotees, and he finds the hoary ascetic who's meditated for 80 years but has a really stinky attitude. And then he sees the drunk guy who doesn't seem to be doing anything, but he has a wonderful attitude. He has total faith in God. He has total belief that everything is going to be just wonderful. And it turns out that he's far more advanced than this other fellow. Because in the spectrum of, you know, what's available to me, this is what I can do. One of Sri Ramakrishna's most devoted disciples was this man named Girish Ghosh, who was a Bengali playwright. And he was such a libertine and a drunkard and I think he was a drug addict and a womanizer and all these things. But he really loved God. And, you know, everyone else would get so upset about all the things he was doing wrong, but all his guru saw was what he was doing right. It's a very important lesson. We just have to look where we stand and not worry about it. Can't judge yourself by anything but you. That's all. If this is your worst and this is better than your worst, that's a huge victory and you should claim it. That's, again, you see, that's right attitude. Don't worry about anything except just making your attitude a little better than it might have been. Does that help? Okay, let's take a little bit of a break. Then we'll go on. We'll get to positive thinking at all times. Okay, you ready to go again? I'm going to just skip through the first part of this, and I'll come back to it next class. I hope you all don't mind. I'm just obviously taking a very leisurely stroll through these notes. It's a great pleasure for me not to feel in any hurry. So there's 16 sections, and who knows how long it'll take us to get through them. After I learned my lesson with the Gita, having committed to 10 pages at a time, I was so annoyed so much of the time because there was so much in there I couldn't deal with. I would still be teaching the Gita if I hadn't done that, though. Whatever 2 or 3 years it took us, we'd still be on it. We'd probably be on the second chapter by now. Okay. I just want to get into the second of these 5 attitudes. The second of the 5 attitudes, it's very interesting that Swami really does focus it down to 5, is he calls it positive thinking at all times. And is it Norman Vincent Peale who made such a big hit with the book, The Power of Positive Thinking? And there's a whole lot of different ways that that whole concept can be oriented. And in our Raja Yoga classes and also even in superconscious living, the system of superconscious living, these are all different things that you can study with us. Adam and a few of us were lamenting at the beginning that he's just grown old enough to stumble onto our path. I mean, you're not a child, but you probably weren't alive in 1976. Am I being rude to you? Right, okay. So Swamiji has been building up, Swami and Master both have built up this huge, you know, volume of things to read and study, and what a very difficult situation he's in because it's all there. I mean, for many of us, we grew up with it. So it was like one book every 6 months, maybe, and it was easy to keep up. I was also telling him there was this young woman who came to Ananda, and Swamiji would say to her, well, have you read this book yet? And she would have to say, no, sir. Well, have you read this book? And she would say, no, sir, I haven't read that yet. And about the 10th time he asked her, she said, sir, you took decades to write them. You know, it's going to take me a little while to read them. So the Raja Yoga Course series and the Superconscious Living class talk a lot about positive thinking, about affirmations specifically, and, you know, all of those things. Well, this is not exactly about affirmations, although it's a little bit. It's a little just about how our mind is oriented. And it's so, this is the one I want to get to because I want you all to think about it this week. You know, we're talking about courage, about situations being neutral, but one of the things that gives us courage just simply depends on how we regard what we regard. And people's consciousness varies so much in this. I'm going to tell a story that I must say amused us immensely when years ago the Ananda group, we had this great idea. We would all go down to Self-Realization Fellowship in Southern California, and we would take like 300 people, and we would go visit all the shrines there. And this was one of our cheekier ideas, and so we simply arranged and we went down there to do this, and we did it for a couple of years in a row, and then SRF decided it was just too many people at one time. They just couldn't handle it. We weren't able to do it again. But at one point we were at the Encinitas Hermitage where Master lived and wrote autobiography, and it's on a little strip of land on the beach, and Master's house that he lived in, his beautiful cottage, is at the end of the beach, and then there's a narrow strip where there's a path that, and the ocean is on one side, and it's kind of green lawn, and then it gets to the gardens, the manicured gardens, which are all very beautiful. Well, we were a fairly large crowd, and people were going in, not on the cliff side, they were going in on the other side in the driveway, they were going into the house where Master lived, they were touring through the house, and then we were instructed to come out on this path. But of course, you know, Ananda people are not real regimented as a rule. Let me just put it delicately. When I was involved in a political thing at Ananda Village in the 80s, and we were trying to do this controversial thing in the county, and there was lots of annoyance from the people in the county because they wanted to have more control over our development, and we didn't want them to have control. And they were trying to tell me that you're all just brainwashed. You all just do what Swami said. And I used to answer them really seriously. We're not, you know, like this kind of thing. And finally, when it just came up for about the 30th time, I couldn't contain myself. I just burst out laughing. And I said, oh, God, that would be such a relief. You It's just like everybody, it's self-realization. Everybody believes that they're guided by God individually, and it's just like, wouldn't it be nice if they would just do what we said? So we were all supposed to go in, and then we were supposed to come out like this, and we were supposed to go over here, but it was beautiful. It was the beach. It was lovely. We were there to see Master. So people were wandering off the path. They were going over to the edge. They were deciding to go back into the house. I mean, it was like chaos like this. But of course, it was no problem. But I just remember this nun. She was so agitated. She was so agitated because we weren't just coming in and going this way. And she said, and people are going both ways on the path. I said, well, they see each other coming. You know, it's like when they see each other, they just like move aside and then just walk. But it's like she just couldn't, really, she couldn't handle it. We actually decided just to ignore her. I mean, it was just too absurd. But it was just like, it's a very extreme example. But our examples might not be as humorous in this position, but how many times is something just simply moving a little bit outside of where we ourselves wanted it to be, and this whole thought sets into us that, you know, all these things are going to happen. Oh, really? Do you identify with this? How shocking. Positively, I'm shocked. Totally shocked. You know, it's, of course, it's the way it always is. But whether the way we respond to that has a great deal to do with whether or not, well, let's go to our simple attitude, courage, what to speak of, the way we respond to that has a great deal to do with what happens next. And this isn't to say that we blind ourselves to things. Swami tells in his Rescuing Yogananda book, just to mention another book, he talks about how accepting an easy master was as opposed to the very stern attitude that people now project upon him. And he talked about the monk's dining room. He said it was just a mess. And a master came into it, and they were so embarrassed because they didn't expect master to come in, and it was untidy and wasn't even clean, and they had to, you know, rush to find a chair that they could even sit him on. And he just looked around at this very slovenly situation. He said, well, it could be worse. Just like that. I mean, he didn't not see it. He saw exactly what was happening, and he didn't particularly approve. But even if he didn't approve, let's just put a positive spin on it. Well, it could be worse. And of course, as soon as he says, well, it could be worse, you know, everybody just relaxes and laughs a little bit. Isn't that so? See, the thing about positive thinking at all times is that it frees up our energy to go forward. Because one of the single most sort of killing things to our flow of energy is when we ourselves lose the momentum. And what causes us to lose momentum above all is when we lose hope, when we lose perspective, when we lose optimism. I mean, one of the most agonizing aspects of depression per se is that you become paralyzed. And you know, when you're depressed, you can't do anything. And depression is the exact opposite of positive thinking at all times. Now, this is let me just think for just a second. Oh, I love the way Swami puts that. He says, there are people, he even says this, there are people who are courageous but negative, which is that they do have the capacity to sort of persevere and not be defeated, but still their point of view is always about what's not going to work out. It's a very subtle and one of the most insidious ways to both kill your spirit and to kill the spirit of people around you. I have played this game with myself, which I would like to say that I always do, because I should always do it. But when I'm remembering to do it, it's very, very fun to try to always tell the exact truth, but always couch it in a positive way. You know, so that you really look at things just as they are. You really see that, well, so-and-so really has a huge problem with his overbearing personality. But you can also say, well, yes, he's very strong-minded, isn't he? Right? And you haven't really said something that's untrue, but you've just sort of couched it in, at least it's leaning in a positive direction. There was this woman in our community who had a very over-intense personality. She was really something. Oh, no, there was this other woman who was very, She tended to get angry and then just really speak her mind in ways that she shouldn't. And Swamiji said, well, you always know where you stand with her. Pardon me? Yeah, there was no doubt. But it was just such a, when he said that, it was just so perfect. Because, well, you do always know where you stand with her. And of course, he was implying all the rest of it. And you could tell that he knew exactly who he was dealing with. But let's have positive thinking at all times. And Swamiji talked to himself about when he was a very young man and he decided to be a hermit. And he was smoking cigarettes. And he thought, who ever heard of a hermit who was smoking cigarettes? I'm going to go live in the jungles of South America and like I'm going to have to come out every week and buy cigarettes. It's just like he couldn't really see it. So it was he really realized that he had to stop smoking cigarettes. But it took him a long time to be able to stop smoking cigarettes. But he never allowed himself to say that I failed. He always said, well, I haven't succeeded yet. You know, it's just think of the difference. And that he always quotes Mark Twain, smoking's the easiest habit in the world to give up. I've given it up 1,000 times. But that's a true statement, but just even by its very nature, it makes you laugh, doesn't it? I'm going to tell another SRF story because this one is so great. This friend of mine who has an extremely quick wit, I mean, I don't know how you could be, he's just so quick. And this was when there was a lot of antagonism between SRF and Ananda, and he just happened to be in Southern California, and they were having like an open house at the Lake Shrine or something like that. And so it was a big event, he wanted to go, so he went, and everybody's greeting everyone, and this woman comes up to him, and she says, I'm from the hospitality committee. What's your name? And he told her his name. And she said, well, are you with one of the SRF centers? He said, sort of. I live at Ananda. And at that time, there was so much antagonism that she sort of stood up like this and she turned and she just started marching away from him. Now, most people would just like, you know, collapse, be embarrassed, not know what to do. He chased her. He chased her, tapped her on the shoulder, and he said, excuse me, if you're going to be so rude, probably better not to say you're from the hospitality committee. But you know, just turn it. I mean, he had a tremendous wit, which was a very helpful way to turn it. We can't always be so funny. But whatever begins to come to you, as soon as you watch your mind just beginning to like turn this into another story, just like think about what the positive side is. Remember that story Swami tells us all the time about buying that little tape recorder in New York City that he wanted to use as a dictaphone? And he was in New York and he had the clerk tested it for him. And with all due respect, New Yorkers do not always have the nicest voices, especially New York merchants. So the guy tests the recorder, proves that it works. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, like this. So Swami, he goes to Lincoln Center, I guess. And there's a symphony going on, and it's between the movements of the symphony, like this. And the conductor has his hands up. And Swamiji thinks, I just bought this recorder for dictation, but you know, maybe it'll record this music. Wouldn't that be interesting? So he punches the button. But first he turns the volume way up, just so it makes sure it'll pick it up. So he turns the volume to high, then he hits the button. Of course, he doesn't hit record, he hits play. So the conductor's like this, everything is silent, and all of a sudden it says, testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Swami said it got to 4 before he found the off button. You know, the conductor whirls around like this. And the man next to Swamiji, after he gets it turned off, and he said, what did he say? Let me just think how he put it. Oh, I can't even remember. I think he said something like, maybe better turn that thing off, you know, like this. And Swami said, like, even in the moment when he's frantically looking for the button, he's thinking, oh my gosh, what a story. And of course, he's told it to us over and over again because it's just so marvelous, isn't it? But you know, even in the moment, what a story. What an adventure this will be. A very interesting, I have read, I don't read quite as many as I used to. I like to read true adventure stories and stories about people who face very difficult circumstances and how they overcome them. I think I'm trying to give myself courage and things like that. But this one man, I read a story, he was kidnapped in Lebanon or Beirut or somewhere, and he was 7 years. Terry Anderson, I think he was a well-known journalist. He wrote a very, very interesting autobiography about that experience. But he says he remembered one of the techniques that he learned because he was going into this dangerous area, was if you ever find yourself in captivity, start writing your autobiography with this event in the past. Isn't that interesting? And you just, it's just like you just project yourself out into the time when you're looking back at, you know, what this meant. And so he started, because he was a journalist, he spent a lot of his time in captivity writing the book about being in captivity. And that, you know, puts you forward. But who's to say? Because there's so many divine laws about like attracting like. And if you allow situations to make you negative, then what kind of a vibe are you putting out? You're putting out a vibe that says, oh, things are bad, aren't they? And as soon as you start thinking things are bad, in the Bible, Jesus makes this just really appalling statement. The Bible's full of appalling statements. Last week was, and you know, on Sunday was, I come not to bring peace but a sword, to set the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law and the father against her son. I asked in Sunday service, who would follow a God like that? You know, why didn't all of Jesus' followers say, just no, thank you, sir, I'll go look for someone who's more pleasant? You know, there had to be other things, which of course is what we talked about. But he also says, to those who have, more will be given. To those who have not, even the little they have will be taken away from them. You know, it's just like, this is really not fair. But what he's actually talking about, he's talking about the law of magnetism. Because Jesus, you know, wasn't able in the time and age he lived in to say things as directly as Yogananda could later. But what he's saying is those who have an attitude of abundance will vibrate with abundance, and that positive magnetism will draw more to them. And those who have an attitude of lack, by their very attitude of lack, will cause even the little bit they have to slip away from them because they won't have any magnetism. It's in the other part of, you know, positive thinking, it's not just like trying to twist your energy around. It's realizing if I ever want this to go away, I'm going to have to just turn this, I'm going to have to fix my attitude. And where we get our positive energy, and I'm really not going to finish this tonight, is not from the fact that all the details are going to work out. Because the truth is, a lot of times the facts are grim. You know, not every baby lives. Not every cancer goes into remission. You know, not every orphan gets adopted. Not every trial comes out with justice. Many, many, many things happen. So our concept of positivity can't be, well, I was talking last on Sunday also about the letter that I got. I used it as the beginning of the sermon when the woman recited these bad things that had happened to her and told her she'd lost faith. And I raised the question, what did she lose faith in? You know? And she obviously meant she'd lost faith in God. And when I answered her, and I tried to couch it in a way that would be supportive and not unkind, but it's like, have you lost faith in the idea that God's just going to agree with your ideas all the time? And now that he doesn't agree with you, is it like all over between you? Like, and then what happens when your husband doesn't agree with you all the time? Is it all over between you? And God forbid you should have children. I didn't say this in the letter. God forbid you should have children and your teenagers don't agree with you. Is that all over at that point? You know, like, what is it that we're really basing our relationships on? And if our positive thinking is based on the idea that as long as I'm positive, I get to have everything I want, that's not a very solid basis. Our positive thinking has to be based on another far deeper reality, which is an experience of the fact that there's a benign, loving presence in this world that's wiser than we are. And that we're positive not because this is any fun, but because that behind whatever is happening, we know that, well, as I put it, I think on Sunday, it's not that I have faith that God's going to give me what I want, but I have faith that he will give me what I need and he will give me the strength to deal with it. And then what do we ever have to worry about? But you see, that's a very enormous practice in itself. And this is why these five attitudes that Swami lays in front of us really are the foundation stone of our whole spiritual life. And as I was saying last week, these are the fundamental steps that we just keep reassembling, and we can choreograph any dance, just like a ballerina, with these steps, if we really know how to do them. Positive attitude at all times, positive thinking at all times, sometimes has to force us to go very, very deep into our core belief that God is in charge and he knows what he's doing and he's going to help me through it. Mother Teresa of Calcutta said, "God never gives me more than I can handle, but sometimes I wish he didn't trust me so much." I think that just says it so perfectly. And then sometimes that's how you have to work with it. Okay, now any questions or thoughts before we call it a night? So play with positivity this week and see where it takes you. You can play with courage too if you want. And if you've read ahead, you can even use something that we haven't talked about yet. Okay, we'll see you next week. Let me think.